And now we welcome Ken Stern, who is going to speak to us about the pain of universalism.
So I've been going to church for about 30 years as a Unitarian Universalist. And every congregation has its own culture. And when I was in Toledo, that was a favorite hymn, though I may speak with brave with fire. We sang it a lot. You know, the Rebecca Solnit reading, I ran across Rebecca Solnit in Harper's 5 or 6 years ago. She wrote a piece on leprosy and being empathetic. And I've been thinking about this topic for a long time, as I'll tell you. But I searched the internet for Rebecca Solnit and empathy earlier in the week for the reading for Peggy and for us. And it fits so well, the scandal with our richest people who are cheating to get their kids into college. Really good timing. It's really a tragedy too, but okay. I want to thank you, fellow congregants, for the opportunity to offer this service to you today. I thank Sally for providing the music, and Peggy for celebrating and supporting my efforts, and the worship committee for supporting Peggy and Sally. And I also appreciate Claire, who not only created the order of service for us, but she does so much to support our congregation. As many of you know, I was married to a minister for 10 years, including the years in Toledo. Rank has its privileges, but I also signed up for duty. I jumped into church life with both feet. I taught classes on Unitarian Universalist history, and more than once I preached at small outlying churches, just like this congregation. And of course, being with a minister, there were books. Our ministers are always reading. There was conversation, there were dinners, and there were dinner meetings. Being minister's spouse has been the favorite gig of my life until I came here to publish a newspaper. Which is really good, too. I learned a lot about our faith movement's histories. Our seminary student, Minister Victoria, who has shared some historical moments through her UU 101 sermon series, and she's preaching in a couple of weeks at the end of the month. During her last sermon, she emphasized that not all history is made by great men leading the charge, that there are many smaller events, often involving women and other marginalized people. Of course there are both. The work we do in our time and in our community shape the life and future of this congregation and of this region. We have so much potential. We do have a great religious tradition and history on this continent, stretching back some 300 years. The two sides of our church family are the Unitarians, thinking their way through the Bible. They could not find Trinitarianism because it wasn't there, wasn't in the Bible, being a human construct, a negotiated addition to Christianity about 350 years after Jesus passed. So the Unitarians brought rationality and forethought to Boston. That looks like two pages. Reading the words in the Bible were not enough for them. They needed to research and prove that those words were true. Unitarians, and this is back in the late 1780s, were the first to pursue biblical scholarship in North America, what we today call the search for the historical Jesus. When I started going to the Lansing, Michigan church in the late 1980s, I loved the discussions and the debates. Let me show you how much I know and how smart I am. There was a lot of pride and ego displayed in those days. it's interesting how we evolve as individuals and how we evolve as a culture. And then there are our universalist forebears, the runt side of the family. I respect their history even more. Back in the 1750s and forward, recall almost all of Christianity embraced predestination, the belief that God had decided each person's fate before any of us were born, and almost everyone was going to hell except for the elect. That was the theology of the day. A small group stood alone. Okay, so that was the theology of the day. A small group stood alone, finding in the Bible that God loves everyone and that we all universally go to heaven. They were very, very brave, and they were very persecuted. Imagine the courage to publicly proclaim their faith in the face of universal condemnation. And I won't go into it, but in England, you could be killed for, you would be put in prison, and you could end up being killed for proclaiming your belief in universalism, that God is love and that we all go to heaven. It's an amazing history that we have. Now, the universalists were never Christian enough in the United States. If you fast forward 150 years, 200 years to World War II, twice during that horrific period, they applied to membership in the Federal Council of Churches, the forerunner of today's National Council of Churches. In 1942 and 1944, they said, we'd like to be members of your body, and they were twice rejected. They were told they weren't Christian enough. They weren't really Christian. So by the 1950s, the shrinking Universalists saw their salvation emerging with the expanding Unitarians. The Unitarians come out of World War II, and they're on this humanist bent because our society had in 25 years gone through these two incredible, horrific world wars, and many people couldn't find a God. How can God exist in the face of this reality? So the Unitarians preaching this humanist message were growing. They were attracting adherents, and the Universalists were shrinking, and anyway, they went to a merger talks, and that took place in 1961. And so here's my first funny line of the day. So when you're around, especially Unitarian Universalist ministers, there's jokes in the family. And I heard this one about 20 years ago. So there's a merger. Unitarians are two or three times as many numerically as the Universalists. They have all the power. The Universalists were afraid that the larger Unitarians would swallow them up, that many Unitarians found that the Universalists gave them heartburn. So now it's almost 70 years, it's 70 years later, two full generations, and the immediacy and those tensions of merging are grandparents. It's a long time ago that the merger happened. And that's, here's another. They said historically that Unitarians believed in the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of Jesus, and the neighborhood of Boston. This next one is from the 1850s, perhaps. Thomas Starr King. We have Starr King Seminary in Berkeley. Thomas Starr King was first a Universalist minister and then became a Unitarian minister. And he supposedly asked the rhetorical question, do you know the difference between the two sects? What's the difference between a Unitarian and a Universalist? And the Universalists believe that God is too good to damn them, while Unitarians believe they are too good to be damned by God. So the Universalists, while embracing this God is love thing, and we all universally go to heaven, they were also critical readers and thinkers, and that needs to be lifted up. Hosea Ballou one of our best ministers, and he came out of the backwoods of New Hampshire and Vermont in the 1780s, with probably no formal education, maybe a couple grades as a six-year-old. He wrote a book called A Treatise on Atonement around 1800. It's a book that's still in print today. And in that book, he reasoned that God could not be infinitely divided by three. He said, how can you have infinity and then divide that by three? Well, how big is that? But in A Treatise for Atonement, he named God as Unitarian. He found God as one, not Father, Son, and Holy Ghost. And this is some 20 years ahead of Channing going to Baltimore and having this sermon, Unitarian Christianity, where the Unitarians named themselves around 1825. So that's the universal side of the family. I love that Ballou said that God wanted to happify us. That's a word that he made up. It was humans who need to reconcile themselves with God. It's not that God has to approve of us. We have to find acceptance of ourselves and believe that God loves us and that we're all loved and we all go to heaven. God had not turned away from us. It is humans that needed to embrace God's love. So this is actually all prologue. I wanted to say all this because this is just the warm up. Okay. So today I want to talk about the pain of universalism. Why are we in pain when God's love is universal? And how do we get out of our pain? How do we assist those around us who are in pain? This has been on my mind for years. I am way too long between pulpits and preaching. I was back in Cincinnati from 2010 to 2017, and during that time I was in a relationship with a Quaker, Paulette, and there ought to be a riddle. I couldn't find one, but there ought to be a riddle. What do you get when you cross a Quaker and a Unitarian Universalist? I don't know, because no one has published that. But Paula and I often discussed our faith. We were both active. We were sensitive. We were against injustice. If God is love, I wondered to her, why is there so much pain in the world? And today is my chance to chase that question down. It is not if, but because God is love, that there is so much pain in the world. Our spirits long to be made whole. That's what we sang. How do we get to that wholeness? The key lines connect later, the last couplet of Though I Speak with Bravest Fire. Though I may give all I possess, and striving so my love possess, but be not given to love within, the prophets soon turn strangely thin. The first and oldest pain is from our own internal wounds. Today's message is not about self-love and healing, though nothing happens until I have tended to that. That could be a whole series of sermons and really take me away. But if God is love and God is waiting for us to reconcile ourselves to him, the first step is to love the God within. In Toledo in the late 90s, I was on the board of a local food co-op. A neighbor was a board member, so we drove to the board meetings together. Coming home one night, we went through McDonald's, which is a strange thing in retrospect. I don't recall how we got on this topic, but Mike, who is Catholic and had gone to a Catholic university, said to me, you know, the most important part of that verse in Matthew, love your neighbor as yourself, he said, you can't love your neighbor until you love yourself. We have to love ourselves fully and reconcile ourselves to ourselves before we can love others fully, see them, and reconcile with them. I call that the put your own oxygen mask on first commandment. I can't help anybody if I passed out because I didn't take care of my own first basic need. All the varied and difficult work it takes to heal ourselves is an essential apprenticeship for developing empathy. We sang in the opening hymn, "We who now gather know each other's pain. We connect with others based on the experience and perspective of self-reflection." I led with background on Unitarian and Universalist as prologue to reflecting on John Murray, one of our earliest Universalist ministers in the American colonies and minister at the founding of the Gloucester, Massachusetts Universalist Church, the first Universalist church in the colonies, opened in 1774. Murray did not come to the colonies to preach, but to lose himself in the wilderness just beyond the sight of the eastern seaboard, death by disappearance. Murray was, in fact, a preacher of Universalist salvation in England. He was first a fervent Methodist, and he would go to gatherings of Universalists to hector them into seeing the errors of their ways, but oops, he ended up converted. He became a lay Universalist preacher. And this is all true. This is his biography. Then his life turned completely upside down. Like almost everyone in the room here today, he had tragedy in his life. But the poor man, not yet 30, was hit harder than most by life's tribulations. In a short period of time, his baby boy died, and then his wife died soon after. Murray had been successful in business, but life lost all interest to him. He fell into debt, and these are the days of debtor's prison, Charles Dickens, and he was sent to prison for being in debt. Friends bailed him out, paid off his debts, but Murray wasn't interested in life. He had heard about America and decided to go there. We understand, of course, that going to America in 1770 was like going to the ends of the earth today. It was literally out of his world. We know this story because Murray kept a journal and late in life wrote his autobiography, and I'm not sure that's in print, but I bet you could find it. We have all the details, chapter and verse. By his account, it is our faith's one certifiable, verifiable miracle. It's my favorite founding story of our religious movement. So July 1770, Murray sails from England in a brig named the Hand in Hand. They stop in Philadelphia, and then the ship heads to New York. And this is where the miracle starts. Just outside of New York, the ship runs into a dense fog. The ship got lost. The fog lifts as suddenly had come, and the ship and crew find themselves over a sandbar just off Cranberry Inlet in Barnegat Bay on the Jersey coast near the small community of Good Luck. It makes me think of like a Star Trek story, and there's off of the universe somewhere on some small planet, a ship gets lost and stuck. They're near the small community of Good Luck, Jersey, or New Jersey, and they were also stuck on a sandbar, and the ship of that size should not have been there. No one would knowingly sail there, and then the wind shifted. And we're on the ocean, but I'm not a sailor type person. But the wind shifts, and the boat's not going to move until the wind shifts again and it's going to blow it out of the inlet. So Murray was assigned by the captain to go ashore to secure provisions for the crew. He comes to a settlement, and he knocks on a door. It's the house of Thomas Potter. Thomas Potter is a successful merchant in this small community, and having reached success, he builds a chapel on his property. He was a bit of a free thinker, and he was looking for a like-minded preacher. Potter tells Murray that he, Potter, and this is a quote, "has been expecting you a long time and have much to say to you." Potter had heard a voice that morning telling him, quote, "This is the man I have sent to preach in your meeting house." Potter was looking for a special preacher, again a quote, "a very different one from the one we have ever known. He will preach to you the truth as it is in Jesus." Murray tells this in his autobiography. When Potter found that minister, he would turn the chapel over to him. Potter had Baptists and Quakers and others who are coming through and preaching on Sunday mornings, but their message does not fit Potter's theology, and who firmly believed that all mankind was equally dear to God. So we have Murray, universalist lay preacher, but he was through with everything except hoping for his own early death. He had not come to the New World to sermonize. Once the wind changed, he was sailing to New York. And then Potter surprised him again. He says, "The wind will never change, sir, till you have delivered to us in the meeting house a message from God." Murray hadn't expected to preach. He didn't want to preach. And he didn't want to preach for several reasons, among them that he was going to be persecuted if he preached his message of universal redemption without any allies locally. It was pretty lonely theologically in the New World. So this is Tuesday. Murray's perplexed. He wonders, why would God have chosen a broken reed as his instrument? Murray decides that the wind would be a sign. If it changed, he would get on the boat and go. If not, he would preach. The week goes by. Saturday afternoon, Murray repeated to Potter that if the wind changed, he would sail away. Sunday, September 30th, and it's interesting, we have, you know, the diary and the autobiography, so we have specific dates. Sunday, September 30th, dawns clear and beautiful. Potter had his servants route everyone from 20 miles around. Hundreds were coming to the service. Potter is confident that the dream of his life would be realized. Murray, by contrast, was a nervous wreck. He had nothing planned to say and determined it shall be given to him that in that same hour what ye shall say, which is what Jesus had said to his disciples. If Murray was not inspired, that would be a sign God put no words in his mouth, that he was not God's chosen courier. Interesting how people thought 200 and 300 years ago, their whole relationship with God and the sense that they were getting some truth and they had to follow it. So this miracle, as I said before, is written down. The wind does not shift. Murray does preach. The tears stream down Potter's face in joy. And Murray not only greatly moved the hearers, but he preached the cloud from his own soul as well. I love that phrase. He preached the cloud from his own soul as well. Then the afternoon, the wind shifts. A sailor comes in and says, we're leaving. The wind has shifted, we're going. And the rest, they say, is history. Murray spent the next 40 years preaching. He married again, helped to found a denomination, and lived to the ripe old age of 74. While he found himself in creating American Universalism, it was not an easy or safe life. And he helped himself by helping others. He dealt with his pain by listening and hearing the pain of others. Potter, we don't know about. He proclaimed that day Murray preached the happiest day of his life. So, as I say, a true universalist miracle in our history, and the more they think about it, the more I find Thomas Potter, one of the two real heroes of the tale, and for several reasons, talk about faith, that God would send the messenger of Potter's choice, but what foresight as well as empathy that Potter had for John Murray, somehow seeing and sensitive to Murray's core being and empathizing with Murray when Murray did not believe in himself. So I'm going to close with one more short story about John Murray, again, out of his autobiography. So Murray's a successful preacher. The movement grows. He's invited to come to Boston, which is, you know, one of the two biggest cities in the colonies. maybe three biggest cities, New York and Philadelphia. And so then, as now, worshiping had its dangers. Someone threw a rock through the window when Murray was in the pulpit, intending to injure or intimidate him. Murray calmly steps over to where the rock rested, picked it up, and said, "This argument is solid and weighty, but it is neither rational nor convincing." Then, after all his friends suggested that the situation might be too dangerous for him to proceed, he proclaimed, "Not all the stones in Boston, except they stop my breath, shall shut my mouth or arrest my testimony." So that's John Murray, one of our early founders, a person who knew pain, and I think I knew the pain of others, and yet could end up preaching that God is love, and may it be so.
And now, if you will join me in hymn number 298, "Wake Now My Senses."